Good morning, everyone. I'm really happy to be back with you. I hope you all have had a good year, and I guess it's been a year since I've been with you. So lots happened over this year. I can't even go through all this stuff, but a big thing in my life was back in December, my book that I'd been working on for 8 years came out, published by Oxford University Press, Why Are There Differences in the Gospels? And it's an academic publisher. It's so they don't expect to sell a whole lot of copies. They usually will sell maybe 500 copies of an academic book because libraries around the world buy them. But when the book came out in December, they had printed just under 1,000, and they were already taken by pre-orders. So that was pretty cool. So it's in its second printing, and thanks. So for every 35 cents I make a book, you know, that's exciting, very exciting. So I'm on my next research project now, and let me tell you what led to this, because when I finished that, it's like, I think I'm going to take a break now in my research. I'm just going to just take a break. I'm just going to do reading of all these books on my shelves that I've bought over the years that looking for the time to read. I'm going to catch up on this stuff finally. And then last spring, I was asked to debate probably the most leading skeptical New Testament scholar in North America. His name's Bart Ehrman. He teaches at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. He's an agnostic bordering on atheism. We've debated several times before. I consider him to be a friend, not a close friend, but he's a friend, a warm acquaintance. We've had some good debates, spirited debates. So we did this written debate. It's the first time I've done a written debate. So we did this written debate on, are the Gospels historically reliable accounts of the life of Jesus? And it went really well, at least from my view. I think it went really well. So they're putting that into a book, and that's coming out later this year. But if you're interested, you can read that debate now for free online. You can just go to risenjesus.com/gospels. And that'll take you right to the page where you find it. I've been fine-tuning my arguments since then. I just submitted another book proposal to Oxford, and they were asking me for this. First time publishers have been coming to me now for to put my book with them. So it's pretty cool. So we'll see what happens there. But so I've got all this material on it, and I can't share all of it with you. So I'm just going to do a little bit with you today, and there we go. We're going to talk about the historical reliability of the Gospels, and I'm going to just give you a little bit that will wet your whistle on this topic. So as we get into this, the first thing we have to ask, you know, you may have to, this isn't reaching well, so I'll just point to you, okay? First thing we have to do is we have to ask, what is it we actually mean when we say the Gospels are historically reliable? What does it mean to say something is historically reliable? It does not mean inspired, infallible, inerrant, authoritative. And why do I say that? Because you can look in, let's take the Psalms for example. We believe the Psalms are divinely inspired. We believe that they're the inerrant word of God. We believe they're the infallible word of God. But are the Gospels historically reliable? It's not a trick question. Are they historically reliable? No. No. Now, that doesn't mean they're historically unreliable, but we wouldn't say they're historically reliable. What about the parables of Jesus? Are they historically reliable? No, they're parables. The Good Samaritan never existed. When you talk about a parable, these are fictitious stories. So we wouldn't say they're historically reliable. Are they authoritative, infallible, inerrant, divinely inspired? Yes, but we wouldn't say they're historically reliable. What about the Proverbs? Are Proverbs historically reliable? No. That's not to say they're unreliable. It's to say it is... It's not a relevant question. It's like saying, does the color blue meet EPA standards? right? You wouldn't say that. It's irrelevant. And we wouldn't say, are the Psalms historically reliable? Because it's not historical literature. All right, let's look at a different question. The Annals of Rome by Tacitus. Tacitus is one of the finest Roman historians. He wrote at the beginning of the second century. Historians would regard Tacitus's Annals of Rome to be historically reliable. But are they divinely inspired? No. Are they infallible, inerrant? No. Here's my point. You could have something that is authoritative, or I'm sorry, you could have something that is historically reliable, but not divinely inspired. You can have something that's divinely inspired, but not necessarily historically reliable. Or, at least in theory, you could have something like the Gospels and the Book of Acts that's both historically reliable and divinely inspired, inerrant, infallible, authoritative. Today, though, we're only asking the question, are the Gospels historically reliable? The question of whether they're inerrant, infallible, divinely inspired, authoritative, is an entirely different question. To say that they are historically reliable is what we're focusing on today. All right. One thing we have to keep in mind, or I should say a couple things, is when we are defining historically reliable, and what I mean by this is, since it doesn't have to be inerrant, that means something could have errors in it and still be historically reliable. So then we'd say, well, how many errors? What kind of errors? And see, this is not a simple question to say, are they historically reliable? We have to define this. So in coming up with the definition of historically reliable, we have to be fair, and it's got to apply to all ancient literature, or at least historical literature, we would say. We don't want to privilege the Gospels to say, well, let's define historically reliable in such a way that the Gospels will pass the test, and then we'll apply it to other ancient literature, right? That wouldn't be fair. We wouldn't let a Muslim get away with that. We wouldn't let a Mormon get away with that with the Book of Mormon, or Hindu with the Veda, or anything like that. So we're going to look at ancient literature, let's say. It's got to apply to ancient historical literature that historians would regard as historically reliable, and then let's see if the Gospels meet those same criteria. In doing that, we have to consider genre, or the literary type, the literary form of the Gospels or of this ancient historical literature. And this is important because ancient historians had different rules than we have today when we write history. For example, how many of you saw the movie Apollo 13? All right, most of us. Now, I remember when the real Apollo 13 was going on in April of 1970. I was almost 9 years old at the time, and I was really into the Apollo stuff. I wanted to be an astronaut when I grew up. I remember when I lived in Virginia Beach, there was a friend, one of our donors up there. He was a pilot for TWA, and then he was taking me in this one-engine airplane, and he says, here, I'll teach you how to fly. I said, great. And so we were doing this thing a couple of times, and he said, all right, I want you to bank it on its side, and I want you to go around in circles. So I put it on its side, and we're going around in circles. And I'd played, you know, video games, Microsoft Flight Simulator, Combat Flight Simulator, so I knew what I was doing, of course. And so I had this right, but I wasn't doing things right with the rudder. And so all of a sudden he said, hey, Mike, you better pull it up. We just dropped 500 feet. And so I did. And I thought, oh, and my stomach just felt really horrible. And I felt green for the rest of the time. I was trying to hold my cookies down. And so I gave up the astronaut thing. I'll go back. So with that movie, Apollo 13, you had Gene Kranz, who was played by Ed Harris. And he ended up writing a book about it, Failure is Not an Option. If you remember, that was a famous tagline of that movie, right? They were trying to put together how to solve the astronauts' problem at this point with the carbon dioxide, filters. And he said, let's get this thing together. Failure is not an option. Well, Ron Howard, Opie, who was the one who directed this, has been praised for the accuracy of the movie. But it may be surprising to most of you to learn that Gene Kranz never uttered the statement, failure is not an option. And what happened was when the screenwriters were interviewing the people who had actually worked at Mission Control, Flight Control, they just were so impressed with the attitude and approach that they had. And you got to remember that they are taking this story of Apollo 13 that occurred over a 9-month period, and they're condensing it down to 2 hours. So they want to tell the story truthfully, but you're not going to be able to include all details, and you've got to take some sort of artistic license to communicate truth at times. And so what they did was they came up with this statement, failure is not an option, in order to epitomize the attitude and approach that those on the flight control team had towards solving the problem. So is this a historically, when Gene Kranz says failure is not an option, is that a historically reliable portrait of what occurred? Yes. Is it historically reliable in a precise sense? No. But is it accurate? Yes. As long as we understand what they're doing here and the kind of license that, say, Ron Howard was allowed to do at this point when writing a movie, we would say it's historically reliable. Well, if you grab that concept there and you apply it to ancient historical literature, you'll be right on, okay? Because that's the kind of stuff that they would do. So historically reliable, we're talking about at minimum here. It could be much more. So if we say something is historically reliable, it could be accurate in a precise sense. What we're talking at minimum, the minimum requirements for historically reliable is, when we say something is historically reliable, it gives an accurate gist of what happened. It gives us a true representation of what happened, although not necessarily in every detail. It's essentially true. It's true enough. Now, something that my wife and I talk about at times is the difference between the guy version of a story and the girl version of the story. And we all know that difference, right? Girls like, and I'm speaking generally here, girls like details, lots of details. They want to know what happened, why it happened, when it happened, how it happened, who was there, what they were doing, what they were wearing, what they were thinking, and how they feel about what happened. And then they want to know how you feel now that you know the story. Guys are different. We like bullet points. Get to the bottom line, the game's coming on in 5 minutes. We don't care about a lot of the little details if they're not significant or really contribute. We don't care about those kinds of things. And so when we tell a story, we will sometimes adapt the details. We will eliminate things. Just yesterday, I sent an email to a friend of mine explaining a situation of a friend of ours in Houston, and I was telling my wife about it, and she said, well, did you say this? I said, no, I didn't. Well, did you say this? No, I didn't. And she got mad at me. So this is just the difference. Now, it's not that I'm trying to give an incomplete story. It's not that I'm trying to deceive the recipient. It's that this is just, my recipient wasn't interested in all these different details, okay? And I know that, so I'm not interested in sharing them. So I would say, listen, it's true enough, all right? It's essentially true. That's what we're talking about here with ancient historical reporting. So there's 5 criteria, I think, that we can look at to say, if these 5 criteria are met, all of them must be met, at minimum, then we would say that something is historically reliable. Let me just articulate what those 5 criteria are. Number 1, historical intent, meaning we have good reasons to believe the author intended to write accurate history. Number 2, we have good reasons to believe that the author used good judgment in his choice of and use of sources. Now, I use the masculine pronoun his because in antiquity, pretty much when you're writing historical literature, it was men doing it, all right? I'm not trying to be whatever. 3, we have good reasons to believe that the author was capable of reporting accurate history. Number four, we can verify numerous reports in that piece of literature as being true. And number five, no more than a very small percentage of what is being reported can be shown to be false. Now again, we're applying this to all ancient literature, and we're saying this is minimum stuff. So these are the five criteria. Now, I don't have time to get into all of them today, so what I'm going to do is I'm just going to look at number three, and that is, do we have reasons to believe that the author or the author's sources were capable of recalling stories accurately? And here I want to talk about conjecturing, large-scale conjecturing. Now, Plutarch, this isn't the guy in Hunger Games, this is the real Plutarch. He wrote around, he was born around the year 40, died just after the year 120. So he's living during the apostolic age, okay? And much of what we know about the ancient world comes from Plutarch. He's a really great writer, very entertaining and an easy person to read. And what Plutarch says, he wrote over 60 biographies, of which 50 have survived. And so he writes about Julius Caesar and Pompey and Brutus and Antony and all these figures. And he's writing about them about 140 years after their deaths. So he doesn't have to come up with large-scale conjecturing, filling in the blanks and crafting stories with inventing details, because he's got really good, reliable sources at his disposal, because these people lived only about 140 years before. However, when it comes to, next slide, please. When it comes to Theseus, the legendary founder of Greece, and Romulus, the legendary founder of Rome, it's a different story, because Theseus allegedly lived about 1,000 years before Plutarch, and Romulus 800 years before Plutarch. So when we read the beginning of Plutarch's Life of Theseus, here's what he writes. "Now that I have traversed those periods of time which are accessible to probable reasoning and which afford basis for a history dealing with facts," and he's referring to his biographies of Caesar and Cicero and those guys. He's just written those, and then after that he's going to turn to Theseus and Romulus. So now that he's dealt with these, for which you've got good reasoning involved, good sources involved, "I might well say, of the earlier periods of which I'm about to write, what lies beyond is full of marvels and unreality, a land of poets and fabulists, of doubt and obscurity. May I therefore succeed in purifying fable, making her submit to reason and take on the semblance of history." What Plutarch is saying here is, look, when I'm writing about these guys that lived about 140 years before right now, I've got really good sources. But when I'm going back this far, 1,000 and 800 years, I don't have all those sources. I don't have good sources. All I have are accounts written by poets and those who write myths. And so what I'm going to do, it's hard to distinguish what's true and what's not. So I'm going to take and I'm going to just cut out a bunch of things that are obviously myths and legends, and I'm going to craft the story in such a way that it comes across as though this is a legitimate history or biography. But don't be under any illusion that it is. So when it comes to these times in which it's relatively recent, Plutarch can write an accurate story, and he's writing just after the Gospels had been written. But when we're looking back way into the past, then large-scale conjecturing is involved. When we come to the Gospels, scholars are virtually unanimous that they were written within 35 to 65 years of the life of Jesus, maybe even earlier. And so there's no reason for the Gospel authors to be engaged in large-scale conjecturing. They didn't have to invent a bunch of details. They had eyewitness testimony. The eyewitnesses were still alive. So they don't have to get involved in large-scale conjecturing. So that's one thing that is a face card in the hands of us when we talk about the reliability of the Gospels. Another thing pertains to memory. Now, there's been a lot over the last few years, 5 years or so, that some scholars out there are trying to assault the reliability of human memory. And they will point out various stories, such as the Challenger space disaster. Do you remember that back in 1986? Anybody remember where you were? I remember exactly where I was when that happened. And the reason being, I was interested still at that point in space things. But they interviewed a bunch of college students, I think just a few months after that, and they said, you know, where were you? What do you remember about it? And they took down their memories. Well, then 6 months after that, they came back to them and they said, all right, let's ask you the same questions. And then they did, and they got a lot of different answers. And then they said, well, did you know you said this back 6 months ago, and now you're saying this, and it's you're contradicting yourself? And they said, well, yeah, I don't know why, but I'm right now. I'm correct now. So it just shows that human memory can get corrupted over a relatively brief period of time. And so they say we can't really trust anything based on the eyewitness testimony because of the fallibility of human memory. All right. But those challenges really miss the point. And the point is something that really applies to us, that interests us. We tend to remember those things more than things that do not interest us. So, for example, I was in a doctor's office a few years ago, and I'm coming out after my appointment, and there's all these people in the waiting room, and I remember walking past this guy. He had to be in his late 80s, and he was wearing a baseball cap with a B-29 Super Fortress on it. Now, my wife and I love everything related to World War II. And so I walked out of the office just smiling, thinking about that guy probably flew on one of those. And then it got my curiosity got too much to me. And I walked back in the office, and I walked up to the guy and I said, excuse me, sir, did you fly on a B-29 in World War II? He said, I sure did, son. I said, wow, you must have some interesting stories. Yeah, I was in the Pacific Theater. I'll never forget the native women on that island. They had a horrible odor to them. And here it was nearly 70 years later. That odor still stuck out in his mind. 9/11, how many of you remember 9/11? Okay, you remember where you were at? What was the weather like on 9/11? Beautiful, yeah. It was beautiful. It was kind of like, I don't know, I was in Virginia Beach at the time. Little chill in the air. Fall was coming, but it was just beautiful out. You remember what you were doing when you learned that we'd been attacked? Yep. Let me ask you a question. What was the weather like on 9/11 last year? Now, why is it that you remember the weather on that particular day 16 years ago, but you don't remember what the weather was like on that day last year? Because last year on 9/11, unless something tragic or great happened in your life, it wasn't a special day for you, right? So there's no reason for the weather to stick out to you as something to be burned into your memory. But there was for 9/11. If it applies to us, if it does something to ingrain something in us emotionally deep set, it tends to be something that we remember, even in the peripheral details. And we might confuse some things over time that in the peripheral details. That happens. But we remember the major stuff quite well, even decades later. Now, Vietnam is something I look at a lot and have interest in, just because I remember growing up during the Vietnam era. And I grew up in Baltimore, and I can remember, you know, sometimes I'd walk down, I grew up in Baltimore City, and I'd see the servicemen walking in their uniforms, and I remember all the stuff going on. So, and then back in the late 1980s, early 1990s, I got really interested in the POW MIA stuff, reports of some of our soldiers still being left behind in Vietnam and in Southeast Asia and looked into that. So that was something that really interested me. The movie We Were Soldiers, starring Mel Gibson and Sam Elliott, was something that has also been praised for its accuracy because of the people involved, the colonel, I forgot his name, the major colonel involved who was played by Mel Gibson. He died just a few months ago. And then there was a court reporter named Joe Galloway, and it was about a battle, the first engagement of U.S. forces with the North Vietnamese Army. And it happened for 4 days in November, next slide, November of 1965. It was a harrowing battle. We suffered a lot of casualties. I think 251 American soldiers died, and another 240-some were injured. So something that they'd never forget, just a lot that was going on during that time. Very, very intense. I have a neighbor who fought in Vietnam, and he will not watch that movie because he's still torn up over the war. Well, Joe Galloway, that court reporter, we saw, my wife and I were watching Vietnam in HD a couple of years ago, and episode one, they had Joe Galloway on there, and he was talking about his recollections of the war, and he'd get choked up at times. And then there was this one-minute segment of the interview that really caught my attention. I want you to see this.
I left that landing zone X-ray.
Battlefield, knowing that young Americans had laid down their lives so that I might live. They had sacrificed themselves for me and their buddies. What I was learning was that there are some events that are so overwhelming that you can't simply be a witness. You can't be above it. You can't be neutral. You can't be untouched by it. Simple as that. You see it, you live it, you experience it, and it will be with you all of your days.
Now I want you to imagine a moment that you were a disciple, one of Jesus' disciples. You had traveled with him, and you saw him give sight to the blind. You saw him heal the paralyzed. You saw him walk on water. You saw him raise the dead. And then you saw him brutally executed by crucifixion. And then shortly after, you saw him alive again, having been raised from the dead. Do you think that if you had seen these things, you'd been a witness to those, that those events would have had an impact on you that were as deep and lasting as those 4 days did on Joe Galloway? Absolutely. So Jesus performed the kind of events that would have been easy to remember. These aren't just peripheral things. These are major things that would stick in your mind. But it's not just Jesus' deeds that would be easy to remember, also his teachings. Maybe you haven't given this much thought, but, you know, Jesus probably did not have to come up with a new sermon for every town and village he entered. Why would he need to? He's preaching to a different crowd. He probably had a dozen to 20 different sermons that he did. And so his disciples, traveling with him for 1.5 to 3 years, would have heard him give the same lectures over and 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 over. And then Jesus would have said to them, look, the best way to learn something is to teach it yourself, and you've heard this so many times, some of them probably have taken some notes, and go out in twos now and teach these things. And so they would go out and they would teach the same things that they had heard hundreds of times. They teach them now over and 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 over. And then they come back and then they say, all right, Jesus, this is what's happened when we were out. Guys, tell me again what you were teaching. Well, we were teaching this. All right, maybe you may want to tweak it a little bit when you're with this. And so he corrects them. And then they hear him teach these things again, over and 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 over. And then he's crucified. He's risen from the dead. He commissions them to go out and preach the gospel and to make disciples of all nations. And then for the next several decades, they go out preaching the same stuff over and over and over, and you get the idea, right? This isn't something that they just heard once. You know, Patrick Henry's famous liberty or death speech was only given one time. There were no notes that survived, and the reconstruction of that speech was made based on two eyewitnesses who did not take notes and who were recalling from memory what Henry said 41 years later. Now, I guarantee you that the teachings of Jesus that we have preserved in the Gospels are far more trustworthy than what we have with Patrick Henry's famous liberty or death speech. Because remember, Jesus' deeds would have been memorable and his teachings would have been easy to recall because they'd heard it so many times and then preached it so many times. And Jesus also put things in such a way to make them easy to remember. He spoke in hyperbolic language. If your right eye makes you sin, rip it out, throw it from you. Unless you hate your father, mother, brother, sister, wife, and children, you can't be my disciple. These are the things that stick in our memories, these hyperbolic language that he would use. He did that for a purpose. He taught in parables because they would be easy to remember. They would be easy to adapt according to your particular audience. So Jesus taught in such a way that be easy to remember. He taught so many times that they would remember, and then he did deeds that would be easy to remember. Yes, they were capable of recalling these things accurately, and remember, they're writing within a relatively short period of time, 35 to 65 years. So this is pretty good stuff we've got in the Gospels. So the five criteria, number one is we have good reasons to believe they intended to write accurate history. We did not cover this. We didn't have time. Number two, we have reasons to believe the authors used good judgment in their choice and use of sources. We didn't have time to cover this. Number three, we have good reasons to believe the authors were capable of reporting accurate history, and we've seen that this is certainly the case. Number four, we can verify numerous reports in the Gospels as being true. This is the case, but I have not been able to show this today. And number five, which we also haven't been able to cover, there's no more than just a small percentage of stories in the Gospels or of any ancient literature that is are candidates for being false or mistakes, errors. So even though we haven't been able to cover these four, but we have been able to cover that third one, during this. So I do think we've got good reason to believe the Gospels are historically reliable. If you want a fuller case, go to that debate with Ehrman, and you can see that this stuff holds up even against some of the most elite skeptical New Testament historians in North America. And Ehrman's probably the leading of them. You can see that this stuff holds up against even the top guys. More information. Visit us on the web, risenjesus.com. That's my website. You can watch any number of our debates there, read some articles, see some of the lectures I've done. Visit us on the web. We got a lot of information there for you. All right. Well, we got some time. Let me open it up for some Q&A. Be happy to take your questions.
Okay, right here. Hey, Mike. Good to see you today. Thanks for coming.
You too, Bob.
Quick question. As you know, I'm really interested in how God is using you in academia worldwide and with the publication of the book, very, very important book for secular Christian scholarship, if I could coin that term, whatever it is. I don't know what the term is, but the secular non-Christians that are teaching about Christianity in this in the universities. What's their response to your book?
Oh, well, thanks for asking. Well, the response of critics, we're still waiting on some of this. I can say that the first academic review, and there's been some comments, for example, Scott McKnight, he's an evangelical scholar, and he wrote a review of it back in February, but it's written by a scholar, but I wouldn't call it it's not in an academic publication, it's a blog, and he said, the very last paragraph of his review is really good. It's something like it was the finest treatment of the Gospels in terms of what their literary genre, how that impacts how we interpret them, that he's ever read. And he's a major New Testament scholar, so that was pretty cool. J.I. Packer, some of you heard of him, he sent me, I didn't ask him for it, but he sent me an endorsement for the book. You can read that on Amazon if you go there. So some of the Christian responses have been really good. There's been some negative ones from the very far right, but typically those who are really respected scholars, even within the evangelical world, have said some really nice things. In terms of the skeptical scholars, the first academic review that's actually published in an academic in literature just came out a few weeks ago, and they were pretty positive about it. So that was pretty cool. It's been endorsed by, Christopher Pelling. He's the leading Plutarch scholar in the world. He just retired from Oxford 2 years ago. Dale Allison, who teaches at Princeton, he's probably one of the top five New Testament scholars in the world, not a conservative by any means. Richard Baucom at St. Andrews University, who is a conservative scholar, one of the leading New Testament scholars out there. So it is receiving some good praise. And I saw the other day in the World Catalog that it is currently in numerous university libraries around the world. It's at Harvard, it's at Columbia, it's at Princeton, it's in places all around. So we're hoping that it will get a lot of influence over time. Why are there differences in the Gospels? Subtitle, What We Can Learn from Ancient Biography. And that's on Amazon. It's on christianbook.com. That's at Barnes & Noble on their website. So if you just, you could just type in my name if you want, and at those websites, and it should come up.
Jerry?
Christianity Today, CT, in its May issue, we were right in the center. They did an interview and several pages on my book and the findings of it in the May issue of CT. So that was pretty cool.
The five criteria, I'm just kind of wondering, is there any speculation as to whether or not those are the only five and that those are sufficient?
Yeah, great question. And that's just the thing I did in my debate with Ehrman as I posited four. I might have done five. But these are things that I've thought about over time. And I came up with those criteria. I'm not saying that others would disagree or agree with them. They might be stated elsewhere, but not so much. Here are five criteria, okay? So I stated them to see how he would respond to that. And he never challenged any of those criteria. And so I've refined them still, given more thought. And that's the thing. You publish a book, and then you wait for reviews. Or you put it in academic journals, you know, or papers, and you run it by scholars ahead of time to see how they will respond to it. And then you adjust accordingly. As of yet, I have not been challenged on those criteria. So we'll see what happens.
Mike, I'm sure you've seen this, but a really interesting YouTube I saw was a rather unqualified atheist debating Bart Ehrman about the reality of the Apostle Paul and the credibility of the book of Galatians. And I was just I've told many people to look at it. I'd like to hear your view of it, but it looked to me like Bart was saying unequivocally the Apostle Paul is who he said he was, and the book of Galatians, one of the most credible writings of any writings in any period of time.
Yeah. I'm guessing you're talking about Bob Price, the atheist?
I don't know who he was. I don't think. This was just a very unqualified person, and Bart was defending the Apostle Paul and the book of Galatians as very credible.
Well, I'm not familiar with that debate, but I can say that there are people out there, they're called mythicists, and they think Jesus was a myth, that he never existed. Now, this is something that there isn't a single credible scholar who's a scholar in a relevant field who really believes this, okay? Not a highly respected one, let's say.
My point is that Bart was defending.
Yeah, of course.
Very clearly said that the atheist said to him something in the ilk of, well, how do we even know that Paul wrote it?
Right.
And he came back, and his analogy was, how do you even know Shakespeare wrote what he wrote? And that that Paul's writing of the Galatians was far more credible than what Shakespeare wrote, of all things. So.
Yeah, and in fact, Ehrman's wife teaches at Duke, and she's a Shakespearean scholar. So that's why he can say these things. And she's a believer, too. Ehrman is not a mythicist. Ehrman is an agnostic bordering on atheism. But, you know, you do have this group of people out there, hardly any scholars. I mean, they're actually... Richard Carrier is the leading of them, who says that Jesus never existed. He has a PhD in ancient history from Columbia. But he's got these really bizarre views, and one is that Jesus never existed. And Carrier's trying to get this view to catch on. But even recently, he said that he can only name 7 scholars in the world who think that Jesus never existed. 7. There are more scholars, serious, there are more scholars who deny the Holocaust than there are who deny the existence of Jesus. And so those of us who are in the field, who are historians of this stuff, we kind of look at those who deny the existence of Jesus and who make these bizarre claims like, well, how do we know Paul existed and all this stuff? We look at them kind of like the judges did on early contestants of American Idol, who come out and they just think they've got this great talent and everybody's just kind of rolling their eyes, you know. They're just laughed at. Nobody takes them seriously. As scholars. So, you know, all I can say is, I mean, that could be, you know, some lectures on how do we know Jesus existed and things, but they have such bizarre arguments for it. Like, for example, they'll say, how do you have the Gospels and the Book of Acts and Paul, who mentioned James, the brother of Jesus, who was called the Christ, or the brothers of Jesus in 1 Corinthians chapter 9, when Paul says, don't Barnabas and I have the right to take on a believing wife like Peter, the rest of the apostles, and the Lord's brothers? Well, how can you have the brothers of someone who never existed? And so they come up with these bizarre things to say, oh, well, the brothers of the Lord, that was just a separate kind of group, and they called them the brothers of the Lord. Kind of like you'd have the Presbyterians, the Baptists, the Brothers of the Lord, you know? there's no evidence for that. And besides, Josephus mentions James, the brother of Jesus. And why wouldn't you list them with the rest of the apostles or with the more than 500 to whom Jesus appeared? There's no evidence whatsoever that there was a group of people called the Brothers of the Lord. So that's the kind of stretch that these skeptics have to go to. They have this approach to interpretation that no credible historian takes. So crazy stuff, but that's what you have out there. And unfortunately, you do have a lot of college students and high school students and even some adults who are falling for this thing because they have no discernment. For them, if you publish on the World Wide Web, you must be a world-class scholar. And all it takes to publish on the web is you have to breathe. You don't even have to type since there's voice recognition software, you know?
Yeah. Mike, one of your criteria was that only a small percent is false to be historically reliable. There's a tendency today, at least, to say if anything from that source is wrong, then obviously that discredits the whole source.
Yeah.
And you hear that in politics and in anything. You know, if you can just discredit one thing, then obviously that's not a credible source. How do you deal with that?
Well, I find a mathematics book that doesn't have at least one error in it. You know, it's going to be, you're going to be hard pressed to do it. Everything has, look, my wife has a really good memory. I know she brings up stuff about me that I have failures all the time, you know? She has a really good memory. She's not right all the time. She's not right some of the time she thinks she is. I'm just ragging on her today. She's not here, so I get to do that. But she has a really, really good memory. But she's not, of course, she's not going to be right all the time. But if she says something about, you know, I regard her as a reliable source. She may not be inerrant, she may not be perfect, but she is definitely a reliable source when she says something. If I know she's not trying to pull one over me, you know, I know she's a reliable source. Everybody makes mistakes. Everybody recalls some things inaccurately. Remember, I would just say we are not trying to answer whether, in this case, the Gospels are inerrant or divinely inspired. We're trying to answer whether they are historically reliable. Do they meet that minimum standard? And I think it does. And that brings to another issue. What if the Gospels did contain an error? Would they be trustworthy at that point since they claim to be divinely inspired, right? Well, the first thing I would say is they do not claim to be divinely inspired. You have to go to places like 2 Timothy 3:16 and some other things to build a case for the divine inspiration of scriptures. But the gospel authors themselves aren't making such a claim. So I could grant, now I do think the gospels are divinely inspired, inerrant, and fallible, authoritative. But if really pushed to an extreme, I could say, well, they don't claim to be divinely inspired, and 2 Timothy 3:16 is just wrong, you know, if there were shown to be some errors. And just because there's some errors in it doesn't mean that they're not historically reliable. If Jesus rose from the dead, Christianity is true, period. Here's something that's very important for you to take with you. If Jesus rose from the dead, Christianity is true, period. Does anybody disagree with that? Okay. If Jesus rose from the dead, Christianity is true, even if it were to be the case that some things in the Bible aren't. Now, the first gospel was probably Mark and probably written around the year 65, around that time, most scholars think. Could have been written earlier, some scholars think earlier. But most scholars think Gospel Mark was written within 35 to 40 years of Jesus' death. All right, so we've got 35 to 40 years that elapsed before the first gospel was written. Now, if Jesus rose from the dead, was Christianity true in that 35 to 40 years before Mark was written? Yeah. So if that's the case, how would a mistake in Mark's gospel or any of the gospels written after nullify or negate the truth of Christianity when Christianity would have been true before any of the Gospels were written? And yet, we allow atheists to set this stumbling block in our path that says if anything in the Gospels or in the Bible is false, then we can't trust any of it, Christianity is false. What? And we fall for that. Don't get tripped up over them saying these things. I like to, when they point out these things, first that they say there's contradictions in the Gospels, well, give me an example of one. Usually they can't. But even if they did, they could pull out a bunch of them, half dozen of them. I'd say, all right, let me say I just grant all those to you. If Jesus rose from the dead, Christianity is still true. And I challenged Bart Ehrman on a dialogue we had on Justin Brierley's podcast, Unbelievable, several years ago. I said, Bart, I don't grant you those contradictions, but let's just say I did. If Jesus rose from the dead, Christianity is true, even if it were to be the case that some things in the Bible aren't. And he said, I agree. So I said, so what's the big deal? What's the big deal about these? You can grant contradictions, but if Jesus rose, Christianity's true, period. And that's the thing to remember. Does that
Mike,
help?
Mike, I'm wondering, have you ever convinced an agnostic or an atheist that, okay, you're right, I'm going to become a follower?
Sure.
Good.
Yeah. Not a debate partner.
I mean, yeah.
There's been several people who have been at my debates or watched my debates on a video afterward, and they have sent me an email saying that either they've become a Christian as a result of watching them, or they're moving closer to Christianity. I've had some Christians who have come back to the faith. They left the faith, and they are coming back because they watched, attended one of my debates. Or I've had three people who have decided to devote themselves to full-time Christian ministry because they got so excited after watching one of my debates. So, yeah, there's a lot of fruit in these. And I did a debate in Austin, Texas this past February against a guy named Matt Dillahunty. And 850 people showed up for that debate. But it has since been watched over 108,000 times on YouTube.
What is the name of that?
I don't know. Just type in my last name. Go to YouTube. Type in Lacona Dillahunty, D-I-L-L-A-H-U-N-T-Y, debate. Lacona Dillahunty debate. And you can watch that. And between my YouTube channel and his, over 108,000 people have watched that since February. And I had an atheist send me a private message from the Netherlands saying that he was an atheist, that he watched the debate. He congratulated me. He says, I thought you did a great job. And we corresponded a little bit because I brought up some things about the supernatural, which I brought up in one of the lectures I brought here last year. And I brought up a bunch of those things. And so he said, you know, I've had an experience that's kind of demonic, and it really frightens me to this day. And I said to him, well, how does that fit in with your atheist worldview? And he says, I don't know that it does. And then said, well, do you think it fits in with the Christian worldview? And he says, well, definitely. So, you know, these kinds of things get people thinking. So debates, I think, can have a whole lot of good fruit that result. I see it all the time. That's why I keep doing them.
I have a cousin who's a Pastafarian, you know, spaghetti monster, this guy. I mean, that's they're atheists, really. That's what it
yeah.
is.
And ask him for his evidence, right?
I know it. That's right. Mm-hmm. Here, Bob.
So, Mike, let me just ask this question right here.
Oh, okay.
Kind of picking up with Mac's question and also tying back in with my five questions about my question about your five criteria. Obviously, you've been doing this for a very long time. And so, even if I were in your position and were attempting to write the book, it would be maybe the first chapter or two could just be full of qualifiers. So in one sense, historical intent, good judgment, capable, numerous verifiable reports, and small percentage fault. Obviously, you're relying as well upon a lot of historical content. Two questions. One, how do you even begin to put something like this together? And number two, I would assume that your footnotes are probably half of the content of your book.
Yeah, well, Oxford likes endnotes, so unfortunately, I prefer footnotes, but they like endnotes. But yeah, those can be quite long. So I just sent in a 10-page book proposal to them for this. So I do have things laid out chapter by chapter and how I would approach it. And the first chapter will be on, you know, what is it we actually mean by historically reliable and defining that. So there I would justify those five criteria. And I would also be applying them to several ancient historians, people like Tacitus and Suetonius and Cassius Dio, Sallust, Asconius, some people like that, and say, well, where are they on the spectrum? If you had a spectrum from, let's say, 1 to 10, and 10 is we would scientific history, how we would do it today. And 1 over here, this would be kind of the poorest kind of history that you could do. Most of it would just be made up, maybe like you have with Philostratus' Life of Apollonius of Tyana, which was written about 125 years after the Gospels, or about 200 years after Jesus. So you have him at maybe a 1, and you have Asconius at 10. Where do the others fit in, and why do they fit there? And then the rest be like other subsequent chapters, be like building a case for where the Gospels are, a chapter for each of those criteria, of the 5 criteria. And then a conclusion. So that would be the first half of the book. And then the second half of the book will be answering what I would call the ABCs, Ds, Es, and Fs of defending the Gospels. And these would be the 6 major objections to the historical reliability of the Gospels. A, for authorship, that you have a number of people out there saying, we have no idea who wrote the Gospels, they're anonymous, and so I build a case for the authorship of the Gospels. B, for bias, we can't trust the Gospel authors because they were biased. C, contradictions. So that would be just a summary chapter of the book I just wrote, plus some additional information in it. D, dating. Would be, some object that since the Gospels were written 35 to 65 years after the events they purport to describe, they're not reliable. E, for eyewitness testimony. And that would be kind of a little bit on what we've touched here today, but building a case for actual eyewitness testimony behind the Gospels. And then F would be the fidelity of the text. How do we know that the text itself we have today is what was originally written? And then G, God and miracles, God and historians. Some would contest that historians can't really adjudicate on reliability when a miracle claim is involved. And I've devoted an entire chapter to that in my large resurrection book, which is over 700 pages. But that chapter's not 700 pages, but there's only 5 chapters in the book, too. But I dealt an entire chapter to God and the miracles and the historian. There would be a summary of that chapter here. So that's kind of the plans for the book and how I'll approach it.
Mike, we certainly appreciate you. Thank you very much.
Well, thanks for having me.